Debug is brought to you today by Automattic, your smart driving assistant on your smartphone. Now, Automattic usually costs around $100, but with this special offer, Debug listeners can get it for 20% off, just $80. Go to automattic.com/debug. And once you get it, you'll save hundreds on gas. You'll never forget where you parked. You'll diagnose things like engine light warnings. You'll get help in a serious crash. It works on both iPhone and Android. Ships in 2 business days. Try it out. If you don't like it, you have a 45-day return policy with free shipping. Just go to automattic.com/debug. You'll find out if you brake too hard, if you speed, if you're accelerating too rapidly, and it'll keep timelines of your trips. It'll just make your car as smart as your phone. So once again, automattic.com/debug.
I've opened a bottle of 2011 Old Vine Zen Gnarly Head. And oh, I'm good. Going to town on it right now.
Oh, excellent.
Is it from a box, Don?
No, it is not from a box. I'm not an animal.
Well, I actually, speaking of box, I opened up a brand new box of a black box Merlot. Oh. So that's what I'll be drinking from. I am an animal, I guess.
You guys are supposed to be drinking Syrah now. I mean, this is so off topic.
Well, you know, I don't buy in the box because I can't fit it. I can't fit the fucking boxes in my wine coolers. I have a couple of wine refrigerators. So I'm a serious alcoholic. So.
I have one of those too, but are you supposed, well, and I'm ignorant and watch this, I'm about to prove it. Are you supposed to put red wine in a refrigerator, in a wine refrigerator?
You're not supposed to put it in the normal temperature that wine refrigerators come in, but I have one that's turned up to the normal temperature for white wines, and the other one, which I turn much farther down because I like a little bit of coolness on the red wines, especially during the summer here, because there's nothing worse than having, you know, a wine turn on you. So my wife and I keep some of our reds very, very slightly chilled.
I love that this is drinking with Don and Nitin.
Yes.
That's what we were talking about today, right? I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was all about wine.
That's the show.
Now tell us about your yacht problems.
No. You know what? My first boss at Sun Microsystems had his own racing yacht, more of a sloop, really. I mean, he used to take it out for team meetings on the bay. In San Francisco, and I actually learned how to like boat that way. And I said, "Well, this is pretty cool. You know, what's it like having a boat?" And he said, "Imagine wearing the finest Armani suit, standing in a cold shower, and shredding $100 bills." That's what it's like. Nice. So no boats. Another house.
Firm no boat rule.
No fucking boat.
No fucking boat should be a t-shirt. I don't know.
No. Well, you've seen that internet meme with the cat that's wearing the suit sitting at the table.
Yeah.
I should buy a boat.
It reminds me of that's Usual so Suspects. No fucking coke on that boat.
Yes. You know, I for some reason I watched The Usual Suspects again, because I've seen it like 50 times a couple of weeks ago. And I noticed somebody in there who's in the cast I never noticed before. Did you know Clark Gregg is in that
movie? I did not.
Yeah, he plays the doctor. Is it totally, you know, I've seen that damn movie like 25, 30 times. Never noticed that. So,
anyway. Who is Clark Gregg?
He's the guy that, he's Agent Coulson in all of the Marvel movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He's been a director. He's actually in way more places than you think he would be.
He's multi-talented.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like one of those guys that he's so unassuming looking that you just don't notice. And turns out he's in.
I mean, he never released an iPhone, but he's done pretty well for himself.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose. Yeah.
So did we unfortunately start the show already? Or
I don't know.
I'm going to edit in the wine.
I certainly hope not, because I don't want to.
I'm going to edit in the wine stuff at the top, and then I'll go to the show.
Whining about your house? Your,
yeah,
oh, your second,
whining about my house. Yeah,
I hear you.
Which is again why I'm drinking wine this time of the day. But of course, you know, as a lesson I learned from a friend of mine at Adobe years ago, when I went into his office early in the morning, we were in a big bug run, and I was trying to describe. I was on the Illustrator team, but he was the lead engineer on Photoshop, and I was on loan to try to help them make a deadline. And I went in to talk about a bug. And he looked a little bleary-eyed, and he opened up. I was talking about the bug, and he was nodding and stuff. And he opened up the drawer to his desk and pulled out a bottle of whiskey. And he, gestured at me with it, and then he said, "Shot." And I said, "You know, Mark, it's like 9:30 in the morning." And he goes, "I don't drink by the clock." So I've always tried to live my life by. By that piece of advice, don't drink by the clock.
It's healthy. It's very healthy.
See, that's right. We'd get halfway into native versus web apps before you guys started drinking.
Oh, I'm feeling like I need to catch up over here. I've been like accelerating right now because it sounds like Don's ahead of me. So
I'm already half in the bag knitting. I'm already half in the bag knitting. So knitting's on Merlot, and I'm drinking Zinfandel like an animal. So.
And again, you guys are supposed to be on Syrah by now. It's 10.10. Living in the past.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a wine story. Do you remember all the actual wine code names with the actual cat code names with the actual release numbers? Because I thankfully have forgotten all of that now.
Oh, God, no. I'm sure I don't. Let's see. See, I'm even trying to figure out now which one was Merlot. Was Merlot Tiger?
Huh?
I think Merlot might have been Tiger.
It might have been Tiger.
I don't know. Oh, there we go.
They just popped into Skype.
Yeah, Tiger Power PC was Merlot.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, wow. And Mountain Lion was Zinfandel. So that was the Mountain Lion was the last one I worked on, but I left before it shipped. So.
Okay. You know what I'm doing right now?
What?
I'm trying to figure out where. So I saw the notification show up on the side where, you know, the link from that Renee just sent. And now I'm clicking around like a moron in the Skype UI trying to figure out how to get.
No, they hit it. The latest version hides.
It's ridiculous.
Comments.
No. The worst thing is that you actually have to, every time you initiate a voice call, you have to go in and figure out how to show the goddamn chat section again. You cannot make that sticky. I mean, it's like they keep redesigning the UI to piss you off. I mean, it's just, it's like I told you before the show started, like my sister screams at me sometimes, "God damn this free software." she says that to keep it in perspective, but...
It's funny, like sometimes, you know, we've been working in the computer industry for so long, and I kind of feel like we've been through so many years of working with GUIs and things like that, that at this point, well, you should be able to figure out any GUI, and you should be able to figure out any app and things like that. And then, and you just run across these apps that are just baffling. And on the one hand, I feel like oh my God.
Like Microsoft Word or something?
Yeah, you know, baffling, like Word. Yeah, these esoteric apps like Word. But then I, on the one hand, I feel embarrassed. Like, God, well, if I can't figure this out, somehow my mom can figure out Skype and I can't figure out the UI. But on the other hand, I'm almost a little bit proud of the fact that, you know, I sort of feel like I've kept a little bit of the normal personness, you know, that helps kind of guide whether a UI is usable or not. Right. I mean, it's.
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what you mean, because a couple of weeks ago, and it happened to me today because, you know, as you all know from the email I sent this morning dealing with freaking IKEA and people who can't do math, I had to scan something in on the Mac. And this is the Mac. This is the, you know, the operating system that we worked on together. And I had to use the scanning UI. And
you poor bastard.
Yeah, you poor bastard is exactly right. It is the worst goddamn user interface ever.
You're talking about in preview? The
No. Well, yeah. In how the hell do you either launch the, you either go into system preferences and you go to the printer icon and you click scanner and you say open scanner, or you go to image capture and do it that way. But either one of them are just the same path to death.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just the worst goddamn UI to try to figure out what it's doing. And
you know what,
it's been like that for years. And what's worse is if you ever try to do something like this on Windows or worse yet, Linux, mm-hmm. oh shit, then OS X's like a breeze.
Well, that's what I was going to say was the only thing that's worse to me, like I'm now used to preview, you know, the UI within preview. If you go in the file menu kind of close to the bottom, there's this, you know, bring up the scanning UI menu item there. But at this point, it's sort of like living next to a dump. I'm kind of used to it. but the problem I have is that UI is just fantastic compared to any and all printing and scanning UI that's been developed by printer and scanner manufacturers.
Yes.
That stuff, if you want to see just trash, I mean, that's, you know, almost the definition of it is just the, you know, the UIs that and if we're recording, please, no disrespect to anybody who's developing printing and scanning software, but it's just,
but,
I mean,
but seriously, get your head examined. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, it's so bad. And it looks like it still uses like QuickDraw, you know, to this day. I mean, it's just, you know, I never see non-anti-alias text until I'm going, ironically, into like printing and scanning software.
You know, it's like a flashback to your Carbon days, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You were swallowing Merlot right then, weren't you?
I literally actually was swallowing. How do you know that?
It's the power of technology. So do you remember, were you in the exec review when I think it was, I can't remember whether it was Forstall or Jaws or somebody lost it in some exec review. And we were talking about, I think it was AirPrint when we were first trying to do it on iOS and yeah. dealing with the printer manufacturers and stuff. And the execs were just incredulous about, you know, things that were basically impossible because these people were so entrenched in doing it the stupid way.
Right. Yeah. And I remember that.
The printer people.
Oh yeah. It's just awful. Just awful. I mean,
someone just flipped out over that. Like the, just,
well, it's like
industry-wide,
you know,
stupidity.
Yeah. It's, and one of the reasons that printing on iOS, which it's still not great, but one of the reasons I think it's actually better than, well, certainly simpler than OS X. You can't scan with any device. There's no solving for that. But one of the reasons it's a little bit better is they spent so much effort to work around those things. But God, people were not happy when they found out various limitations and things like that.
We had David Geltman on the show a while ago. And,
oh, God.
Yeah.
what did he say about this?
The same, but he's not as colorful as you, at least publicly.
Well, Nitin knows this in meetings, that I was actually not the most colorful person in the room, depending on the meeting. Right. Although I was usually second or third. It's usually second or third, but not always the most colorful in terms of obscene and things like that.
And I think that's probably smart, right? I mean, yeah. You probably don't want to be the most colorful. You know, you kind of want to sneak in behind your Forstalls and your, know.
Anyone
your,
with an S or a C in their title.
Right. Yeah. You know, you're kind of going out on a limb if you're the most colorful. Unless you really know where, you know, where everybody stands in the room, it's probably better to be a little more subdued and let people who can take the luxury of being that colorful, take that luxury. That's true.
And rightly so. I mean, you've been in plenty of meetings.
I was just going to say that's the thing is, a lot of times the most colorful person in the room is right. They're absolutely right. And they're talking to somebody else who's maybe not necessarily defending even something that they've developed, but they're just sort of describing how the world works. You know, it could be, you know, the printing and scanning ecosystem. And the poor schlub who has to sit there and describe, you know, all the limitations around printing and scanning and why HP wants things this way and Brother wants things that way. The Scott or someone in that position, they don't care. They're just going off on the person, on the messenger, right? they're kind of shooting the messenger in a way, but they're absolutely right. It's just not something that, you know, the messenger can do much about at that moment.
It's not exactly productive, but it's certainly fun to watch if it's not you.
Yes. And that's the other part is, part of it is you're thinking, thank God I'm not defending or describing the printing ecosystem to Forstall or anything like that. Yep.
By the way, this is something that I was actually going to talk about you, reminisce with you about today, which is the whole concept of meetings at Apple. I don't think a lot of people on the outside realize what these are like. And, you know, we used to complain all the time about boring meetings. But seriously, most of the time, what you really wanted was a boring meeting, because that means, you know, you didn't get shit on, right? Because it was boring. And the interesting meetings, what you never wanted to be was the focus of an interesting meeting for exactly this, you know, this reason. That was just not a lot of fun.
Right.
How many times did you demo for Steve, and things just didn't quite work out exactly as planned?
Oh God. Okay. Let me see. you know, the good news is that and I imagine you did the same exact thing, right? Was when you know you're demoing for Steve, you run through it, you rehearse that technology to the hilt, to the point where, you know, where you know all of the limitations, and you want to be so prepped and so ready. And oftentimes when you're demoing something, I mean, it's shitty pre-release software, right? So it's going to be buggy, and it's going to be, you're really just trying to get the point across of either progress that's being made or
something never give to end customers.
Exactly. But let's see. So the number of times I think I can count on maybe on one hand, certainly, and probably on three fingers, the number of times that I had demos just go, you know, just run into a problem that I didn't anticipate or that I didn't know about. Yeah. I mean, the good news, what I always found anyway, and I'd love to hear, you know, what you thought about this too, was if I was demoing something and if I knew that there was just, you know, we're about to fall off a cliff here, you know, please don't tap that button because it's just all fucked up. You know, it's never going to work. I know. I mean, most of the time, the other thing that would happen is Steve would allow you to demo something to him for about 3 seconds before he snatched the mouse or snatched the phone out of your hand and started dicking around with it himself. And so after the first, you know, one or two times that happens, first and foremost, and Greg Christie taught me this one, was do not fight him. Don't try to fight him and take the mouse back. Right?
It's like I wrote in my retrospective on Steve and, you know, remembering Steve, is if he wanted to drive the demo machine, then by God, you let him fucking drive.
Exactly.
I mean, there was not, boy, Jesus, that was the kiss of death. And Scott explained that to me years ago.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I always knew that could potentially happen, right? And so you use that as part of you build that into your preparation as well, is, okay, there are all the things that I really want to get across in this demo, and there are all the things that I think he really cares about. And then there are the cliffs, you know, that if you hit this button or if you rotate on this view or if you do something else, it's just going to be all fucked up. And if we can't, you know, during the scramble to get things working well enough to be demoable, if we can't get those things fixed, then at the very least, I want to know about them. I want to know about them so that they're not a surprise to me when I walk into that
room.
Oh,
yeah.
And at the very least, if I know about it and if it's not a surprise to me, then I can speak to it and I can, you know, at least let Scott and Steve and Phil or anybody else who's in the room, let them know that we're on it. We know what we're demoing here, right? Mm-hmm. We know the limitations of what we're showing you. We're not just waltzing in with, you know, a half-baked piece of crap and saying, oh, well, maybe it works, or, oh, look at that, we ran into this problem, right? It's, I want to know the all of the things that are going to go wrong. So really, when I'm you know, when I'm thinking about it, it must have been three. I can't imagine it was, I don't think it was more than three times where I ran into a problem and I didn't know what the, I didn't know that it was a problem before walking in. And maybe that's just because we were demoing things, you know, on iPhone, we were demoing things from so early on that I think not even Steve had an expectation that things were going to be working well. So I was able to, you know, at least I could talk around the fact that, yeah, okay, if you're looking at this address book view, please don't hit edit, you know, to bring up the edit the photo UI, because that's just all broken right now.
Well, you know, so, what we did, we cheated sometimes. We would disconnect things, you know, UI elements, so they didn't work. You know, it was like a busy box for toddlers.
Yeah.
You just like you poke at it and it doesn't do anything. Because it not doing anything was better than it crashing, because you know, that leaves a sour taste. The big thing, you know, I've experienced several times where software crashed, but you have to be prepped for it and you have to warn them that that's going to happen. Whatever you did, you never made excuses for it or blamed anybody else. That was like, you know, you just got your ass handed to you if you're going to do it. I watched somebody make that mistake one time. And you know how when you're in a room and it's really super awkward, somebody has said something stupid? This was much worse than that. Much worse. I do not recommend it. I think it was only, like you say, it's like one or two times where something happened and my people didn't warn me about there, or I didn't know that that could happen. I've certainly had other things where, you know, we had misbehaviors or we had the rare crash, but I knew those things were possibilities going in. But and my people learned that there was one thing that I disliked most of all as a manager, and that was to be surprised.
Yeah,
I just fucking hated surprises. Not only that kind, but all kinds. I always told people, you know, if you're going to commit to doing something, I'm going to hold you accountable to that. But if you're not going to make it, do not tell me at the last minute. You know, you better warn me ahead of time, because I do not like surprises. Because, you know, first what's happened is, you know, Scott's going to hand me my head on a platter and then I'm going to go looking for yours. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, that's another reason why that was so, so rare. But the other thing you said was preparation. I mean, I look at other, and this was up and down the line, by the way, preparation for things at Apple. Scott was probably the most prepared person I ever met in my life. Remember his briefing books before the Monday morning meetings, and how much, you know, it's like I wrote that blog post a couple of years ago about after I retired about how Sunday night is a work night for everybody at Apple.
Right.
Because it's, you know, it's the exec meeting the next day. And so you just, you know, you had your phone out there, you were sitting in front of your computer. It didn't matter if you're favorite show was on. This was especially worse after The Sopranos ended, because for a while there, you could count on the hour that The Sopranos was on that Scott wouldn't bug you because he was watching The Sopranos. And that was your reprieve. You could get you could go to the bathroom, you could have a conversation with your family, you know, whatever. But after that, then it was, you know, until, and Scott was a late night kind of guy. He was not a morning guy at all. He was a late night guy. You were basically on until like 2 o'clock in the morning. How many times were you fielding emails from him at like 1:30 or 2?
You know, actually that's the interesting thing is that I remember a lot of, so the emails that I got, and maybe we can piece together the way Scott actually worked on Sunday from this. But I remember my emails from Scott started at about 11 a.m. on Sunday. And if they didn't start at 11 on Sunday, then I always kind of felt like, oh, well, maybe he must be doing something fun today. Or there must be some, you know, I don't know, family
time,
together or something like that.
Oh, really? Because I used to get the stuff from Bertrand early Sunday morning, and I didn't start getting the stuff from Scott. It was random through the day.
Yeah.
But he would always panic at the last minute. I think part of the reason why I got the last minute things was, and probably that happened to Henri and Kim and I, because we reported to him directly.
Yeah.
And so he just took an extra special joy in squeezing us. I don't know. And so he would usually, once he was going through Kim's status that she prepared, he would usually hit, like, my line managers would hear from him in the morning, and I would get CC'd on it. But I didn't get the direct stuff from Scott until usually late at night.
Isn't that a bit screwed up that he's talking to the people that report to you?
No, I did the same. He would always CC me.
Yeah, okay.
But to it's ask funny, it, somebody had written something in a status report or whatever.
It lands on his desk. I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean that's perfect. I never took offense at that at all. And certainly my managers, I certainly hope they never took offense when I would send something to, because I wanted the answer right away.
Right.
Right. Because I had somebody beating me with a hammer. I wanted the answer right away. So I would do the same thing.
Well, and I think that that's another thing that's sort of a difference. I mean, that was something that I definitely noticed when Steve Jobs came back to Apple and sort of brought the new next management along with him. Was before there was really this, Apple kind of as a corporation was very hierarchical, and VPs would talk to directors, and directors would talk to managers, and managers would talk to other managers and, or maybe, employees. And it wasn't until, and this is what I noticed, was it wasn't until Avi and Bertrand and Scott Forstall and Steve and these other the new management team came in that you would just get email directly from Avi. If Avi had a question, he was asking you directly, or if Bertrand had some suggestions on how to implement something, he was just stopping right into your office. Before the next buyout, it was a very rare thing. At the very least for me, I mean maybe this is just because of where I was in my career, but I did hear this from other people too, that the old VPs, they didn't just turn up in people's offices. And in fact, I remember.
No, they were pretty absent. I mean, Darren Adler has told me about this many times. It was, and so is John Yoroji.
Exactly. He was
insanely useful about learning about the old and the new Apple, because I was familiar with the old Apple as a customer and a developer to other companies, but I didn't start working for the company until 2001.
Right.
4 years after Next acquired Apple. John was tremendously useful to me in learning about and he said the same thing, that it was like night and day. But I was talking to Bertrand about this. I don't know, we were sitting around prepping for some, I don't know whether it was Macworld or a dev conference, and we were, how you sit backstage and you're prepping for the show, and we were just bullshitting. And I was asking him about the, which is kind of a stupid thing to do sometimes with Bertrand, just because you can lean into something accidentally if you're not careful with doing that. But he was a pretty nice guy. I was asking him about that, and he said, it's basically that way because everybody that's ex-Next still thinks of the company as being 50 people.
Yep.
The entire mindset of everybody in the management chain was, well, this is a startup, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so it was very flat that way in terms of communication was very flat that way. And that was quite a bit unlike the old Apple. It was much more compartmentalized, I would say.
I definitely remember in the old Apple being terrified when one late night I was working with another engineer, and we were trying to bring up the System 7 software on a brand new piece of hardware that was being brought up. And this VP kept showing up in my office every every 45 minutes. Is it working? Does it boot yet? Does it boot? Can you get to the Finder? Are you, you know, where is it now? And it was just this, oh my God, what, you know, what do I say? And it, and only later, you know, and then I look back at that years later when, you know, I go from, you know, I go from answering some emails from Avi to talking with Bertrand about specifics around how something should be implemented, and just, and just notice that, that huge, huge difference. And you're right. That was, I had heard the same thing from other people as well, was the whole management chain. They still felt and thought of it as this very small company where, you know, where these communication barriers just don't exist. And I think that actually it was a very good thing. I mean, it's a little terrifying at times, you know, when you get an email from, you know, from somebody way up the food chain. The first couple of times you get those emails, you're like, oh my God, I must not be doing my job right, or I must be a huge screw up, or something's going wrong. But after a while, you know, it you kind of get used to it. And actually, I appreciated that. You know,
it's a real time saver.
Yeah,
it's a real time saver. It adds a lot of creates a lot of clarity. And it actually makes you feel more connected to your management,
right?
Which is a very, very good thing. The problem they're having, I think, with it now, you know, because I've talked about the, Renee, have I talked about this before in a show? You know, one thing you, and I think somebody's been writing about this, as the New York Times or somebody's been writing about Apple University and shit like that. I saw some article fly by on Hacker News the other day. I usually don't click on those things because they just irritate me. But one thing, you know, we sort of learned about after the fact is that Apple, other than the United States Army, Apple is the world's largest functional organization. I mean, there are no, Apple doesn't have divisions. You know, Beats may be the first one it ever has. I don't know how that's going to work.
There's the orphan file maker somewhere.
Yeah, the orphan file maker. Well, you know, that was that was a half division, half something else. But yeah.
And there was Claris back in the day too, right? I mean, I think you're talking about modern Apple, sort of post
modern
Steve
Apple.
Jobs Apple, right?
Post Steve Jobs Apple, yeah. It was still, the entire company was run as if it was still Next, because that's the way Steve liked it. And it's so ingrained in the culture now, they teach everybody that. I mean, part of Apple University is oddly spreading the, you know, the Steve vision for how, you know, to make the company that he felt most comfortable with. You could argue that that's not necessarily the most efficient way to do it. It certainly goes against every, you know, business principle you've ever heard of. But it sure as hell's worked well for him. So,
I have to say, I wonder about that though, because on the one hand, there's the organization and there's the structure and the lines of communication that Steve created and just the environment that he created and worked in. And obviously, I mean, there are great successes from that, but can you really, but the other half of that is Steve himself. And I wonder that, can you really build an organization like that and have, you know, sort of this collapsed hierarchy in some ways and not have these divisions and have this very functional organization without having somebody a lot like Steve in the middle of it? And I'm not sure that I unfortunately I don't know enough about Tim Cook to know whether he thrives in an organization like that, but I'm curious and I wonder, can you actually build an organization like that without a leader who complements that structure?
Oh, I think it requires a leader like that who believes in that kind of thing. But you have to remember that, you know, for the last, how long has Tim worked there? It's like 15 years now. I mean, he, you know, he learned at the altar of Steve, you know, how to do those things and how to manage for Steve in Steve's absence. And a lot of people forget that. I mean, Steve was, there were two fairly lengthy occasions where Steve was just not there, and Tim was running the company, and you know, the other senior and executive VPs were doing their thing, and everything happened really well. I mean, iPad basically happened when Steve was away, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
Steve said, we're doing the iPad, and then it was like he was off to, where was it, to get the liver transplant?
Is that Tennessee? Or
Tennessee, I think it was Tennessee. And he was gone for months and months and months. And we, it was Steve's vision to do the iPad, but the actual execution of it was all of us, you know, going about and doing a lot of the details ourselves. So, after that happened, you know, because Apple would never talk about that. That's the way that happened on the outside.
Right.
But after that happened, I wasn't worried about the company. If, you know, Steve disappeared, I didn't expect and was very saddened by what happened a few years after that. But I knew that the company could function without him being there 24/7. And right. By the way, the whole, you know, when you hear the so-called apocryphal stories about, you know, Tim Cook coming to work at the wee hours and staying late, it's not just some PR person, you know, telling you stories to make you think that Apple executives work really hard like that. They really do that. I mean, these people are nuts. I mean, they are there all the time. I know that for Bertrand, certainly when he was there, you would never know what time of the day or night you would get email from that man. I mean,
he didn't really make it a secret either that I don't think he slept more than 3 or 4 hours a night. Right. I mean,
no,
I think
he was
pretty open about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Neither did Steve.
And so it's funny because now when I look at executives at other companies and I have no idea really, but because, you know, because of where I've come from and sort of where I've done a lot of my learning, just looking at these executives and looking at how hard they work and how they're just always on and always answering emails and always working, I only assume the same thing about other companies, but I really don't know that. But Don, I completely agree. I mean, there's, you know, it's amazing the number of emails. I mean, and you've gotten these too, right? Where you get an email forwarded to you that's not to you, it's from Scott, but it's a forward from Steve, and it's just coming at this, you know, crazy hour, right? It's just, you just know that there's just this fire hose of emails that are just going out at 2:45 in the morning, and
yep.
You know, and there are VPs or executive VPs who are scrambling to get answers. And that was just week after week, month after month, years.
It was pretty constant.
Yeah.
So what would the people that reported to you guys tell us about reporting to you guys?
That it was wonderful.
Like the story.
That was wonderful,
yeah, exactly,
guy.
Right.
We were the best managers they ever had, yeah. I think.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so problem solved.
Yeah.
I have no idea what I told my folks. And, you know, you found yourself doing this. If you forwarded something to one of your people at 1 o'clock in the morning and they didn't reply promptly, you know, you got a little annoyed at them. a very tiny bit, but I told people, I explained to them, you know, and I've said this, Renee, I think on the last, I think it was the last show we did when we were talking about hiring and stuff.
Yeah, team building, you know, on Vector.
Team building, I told new managers, I asked them when someone came into my office, you know, said, want to be a manager and, you know, we're going to set you up to do that. And I said, how did you sleep last night? And they said, oh, fairly well. And I said, good, because that's the last one you're going to get. The last good night's sleep you're going to get. Because, you know, it's like that. I mean, it's a stressful job. There's a lot of responsibility and, you know, you always have to be on. I mean, it's not that it's not fun. It's not that it's not fulfilling. It's not that you don't get to work around all these brilliant people. The bad side effect is they're all like workaholic, psychotic, brilliant people. And I've also tried to explain people by using the analogy, because they asked, you know, what's it like being around Steve and Avi and Bertrand and Scott and Phil and Tim. And I said, you know, it's a lot like working in a nuclear power plant, but you don't get a suit, you know, one of those active suits. It's a lot of radiation, and you either learn to survive it or you just die, because it's not like they're not mean people. They're not spiteful people. They're not trying to trip you up. They're just very intense, and, you know, things emanate from them, right?
Right. They're intense. They're looking for the answers. You have the answer, and you cannot get the answer to them soon enough. Right? I mean, that's
that is the best description of that I think I have ever heard. That is just so true. That's exactly it, what he said.
The other thing was that, you know, when I would send these emails out to my managers, there was always, for me anyway, I always, one of the things that I love the most about managers that I sort of, you know, that I think very highly of, was there was this balance between shielding me from the bullshit as much as they could, or shielding me from whatever interference is happening as much as they can, while at the same time informing me and letting me know what's going on and helping me, giving me all the information I need to do as good a job as I can. And so when these emails would come down and you know, and Scott's looking for the answer, he needs the answer, and it's 11 o'clock at night or whatever the hell, and he needs the answer right now. If I can get that answer myself without going crazy, without making myself nuts, and if it means that I can not bug, you know, one of my managers process,
you do it yourself,
then I'll do that, right? Then I do that. And it's only in those cases. For me, it was, I felt like it was kind of a not last resort, really. It was second resort, whatever that means. But it was really, if I can get the answer myself, I'm going to do it. And if just shield my team and let them have a good night's sleep. But if I can't get that answer, or if there's, for whatever reason, I just don't have that information, then I have to, you know, pass it down and find out that way.
And it was always sometimes a roll of the dice. Like you get the email from your boss, like from Scott, and then you would say something, I'm not quite sure about this, and then you would reply or forward, include Scott so he'd get the reply, and you'd send it to one of your people. And the death was, if that person didn't reply until the morning,
right,
then that person has a black eye, right? And you've just given them, made them look bad in front of your boss, right? So,
right.
Yeah, and that's what I tried to explain to people. It's very subtle, you know. It's not required of you, but let's be honest, it's expected.
Right.
and that's what you have to do. And still to this day, people ask me why I retired.
Really?
And it's you know, there comes a time when you go, you know, I could actually enjoy Sunday evening in a whole new other way. And you've done this, by the way. I'm sure that you've been on vacation and taken your laptop or taken your phone or taken your pad. And I don't know how many managers I've talked to or had really long conversations in email on the phone, only to find out later on that they were in another fucking country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's when it starts, to me anyway, that's when it started to feel a little dysfunctional, was when, you know, I'm going on vacation. I'm on vacation, yet I've got my laptop. I'm going to be within, you know, I'm going to have internet access all the time, and I'm probably going to check my email 4 times a day. And that's on vacation, right? Yeah. So, you know, and
slacker, four times?
I know. Well, exactly. Well, I wasn't going to bring, if I went to Hawaii, I wasn't going to bring it to the beach. And yeah. But you're right.
Well,
I
mean, that's, there were times that, that's when it felt what like, you do.
Yeah. And it really did feel like, you know, you say slacker and, you know, and I know you're joking, but I think you're probably also a little serious, but you,
yeah.
You do feel like a slacker if you only checked it four times. Like if you let an email go from your boss and you let that email sit languish for 3.5 hours before you got around to answering it. Oh my God. You know, why am I here?
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't do that. I mean, I had to do something right away. I mean, you either, you know, it's like, you know, I said in the article I wrote for the Loop magazine, you know, when Steve asked you a question, you didn't ramble, and whatever you did, you didn't make up an answer. And if you didn't know, you said that you didn't know.
Yeah.
And more importantly, you told him when you would have an answer. And so sometimes when you would get these emails, what you would do is you'd have to be blunt and say, I don't know. Here's what I'm doing to get you that answer and when I expect it. You said, as you know, your kids were begging you to go out and see this nice site in France, you know, you were, or wherever the hell you were at. I mean, that's just what you did. And, you know, and I sometimes have young people come up to me today and ask me, you know, about being successful in this business. And part of it is, you know, just dumb luck being in the right place at the right time, which I think, thank God I listened to my wife and I took the job at Apple. But the other thing is you have to realize to really, you know, be successful to ascend, it's kind of a Faustian bargain you make, depending on where you work. And if you're not willing to pay that price, you know, it's not going to come to you. I hate to say that. And so you have to ask yourself, is that really the way you want to live your life? Because it's not like I recommend it either. I mean, yeah, you have to think long and hard about that. And I know I've read a lot of studies on, you know, how this is a stupid way for the tech industry to function. And that's certainly true. But this happens all over. It's not just the tech industry. It's just, I think in the tech industry, it's like on steroids. Just because of the nature of communication and what we tend to do. But damn, there is no way you can cruise through a job at Apple Incorporated. That just does not happen for anybody I've ever seen.
I'm going to take a quick break so I can tell you about Lynda.com. Lynda.com is an easy and affordable way to help individuals and organizations learn. You can instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on software, web development, graphic design, and more. I like to think of it as a repository for information readily absorbed by your brain. They have fresh content, new courses added daily. It's easy to use. There's high-quality video tutorials. It's great tools. There's searchable transcripts, playlists, certificates of course completion, and it covers the gamut from beginners to advanced. If you just want to learn a new piece of software, maybe you're an expert in other pieces of software, but you want to get better at a certain one, you know, whether it's just, you know, as a hobby or to improve your career or to get a job you're looking for, they make all of it accessible and easy. $25 a month gives you unlimited access to 100,000 video tutorials, and you can watch them on the web, on your iPhone, on your iPad, on your Android phone. There are even premium plans where you can download courses to your iPhone, iPad, or Android to watch them offline, and also download project files and practice along with your instructor. Some of the newest courses they've added are Managing Your Mobile Photos, Google Docs and Sheets for iOS First Look, iPad for Business, Up and Running with OpenGL, Creating Mobile Games with Unity. One of the nice things about Lynda is that they have some of the best people in the industry teaching these courses, but they also get them online so incredibly fast. You know, if Apple introduces something new, chances are as soon as it is shipped, Lynda will have a course for you. If not that day, then incredibly soon thereafter. I like Lynda because everybody learns differently, and this is not often accounted for in traditional courses. But with Lynda, you set your own pace. You can watch a little bit, or you can watch a lot. You can watch it at home. You can watch it on the go. It really molds itself to the way that you like to learn best. So we've worked out a deal with Lynda.com to provide you with a special offer to access all courses for free for 7 days. All you have to do is go to lynda.com/debug to try it out. That's lynda.com/debug. Believe me, your brain will thank you.
Yeah, that was actually, speaking of the, when you were saying, I don't know, and when I will have an answer for you, for me, that was sort of a turning point in when it became a lot more comfortable for me to interact with Steve and with other executives as well, where...
When you learn to do that?
when I learned to do that, right? Where, I mean, the first thing is, I mean, sort of the first step in that education of learning how to deal with someone like Steve Jobs is, oh my God, I need to know everything, right? Holy shit, this demo needs to go flawless, right? That's your first thought,
Exactly.
I mean, if you ask anybody who's rubbing two brain cells together, that's what they're going to strive for, right? Is they want this demo to be as perfect as every demo that Steve has ever given, right? And if it's not, then he's going to rip your head off, and oh my God, that's the world comes crashing down around you. When I got to the point where I understood that I could say, I don't know, but I will have an answer for you by X, or I don't know, but let me get that information for you and I'll have it back to you by this. And just knowing that was a satisfactory answer in a limited set of circumstances, that became kind of a relief.
Yes.
You know, was just that I don't have to know everything. I don't have to have all of the answers right now. That doesn't mean that I can let up on the rehearsals that I do. That doesn't mean that I can't know every fucking bug that's in this busted piece of software that I'm going to show my CEO. That doesn't mean that I can't slack off on preparation or on understanding or things like that. It's just acknowledging that
what it means is you can actually swallow your food now.
Right. That I can get a couple hours of sleep at night.
What it does is it puts off the inevitable stroke.
Right. It doesn't eliminate it. It just puts it off, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. So,
right. And that was a very big, for me anyway, that was a big turning point, was when I realized, I mean, in some ways it was sort of calibrating with the executives and understanding where was the bar? Right? How much did I have to know, and how much did I have to sort of have off the top of my head, as opposed to what are the things that I can, you know, I can go and get the answers, and that's okay. And part of it probably also was just meeting with Steve enough, or meeting with Avi or any of these other execs enough that hopefully there was a little bit of trust built up on their side too, right? That you're not a bozo enough times.
You got over that initial set of flinching that you did, right?
Yes. Or you could hide the flinching pretty well.
You could hide the flinching. So it was really good for you because you got to see, you know, the older Apple, and you got to see the new Apple, and you actually, well, obviously you knew Scott. You worked for Scott before he became a director, right?
Right. Right, exactly.
So, and I started working for him, like, you know, it must have been like 1 month after he got promoted. So it wasn't that far off that. And
did you guys ever work together? Because Neaton, you did mail, right?
Yeah, we
crossed paths an enormous number of times, sure.
Yeah, no, I figured, but
definitely.
Yeah, okay.
I think one of the first times that I really remember working with you and with your team, Don, was when we were adding HTML composition to mail.app.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And it was, you know, and just working through that. And it's one of those things that, I mean, it sounds so easy, you know, if you have a you know, if you have
Were you working for Bruce then, or?
No, I never, actually, I never worked for Bruce. I was managing the mail team.
Yeah, you were managing the mail team, right?
Yeah, I was managing the mail team, and I think at that point I was working for Henri, who was, I believe, a peer of Bruce's.
Right, right.
I think that's how it worked out. But yeah, there was, so yeah, we put in HTML support, and it's my understanding that that was the first time that we added sort of the ability to, I mean, that was the first time, of course, that we added, you know, just the ability to edit a web page, right? I mean, that, which is effectively what you're doing in email. Yeah. When you're composing using HTML. And that was the first time that I got to work with a lot of the really great people on your team.
That was a very, very good collaboration, because I thought that worked out really, really well. Because weren't you guys using the old HTML display?
Oh, God.
Before, yeah. Oh, God is a great way to describe that. Not to disparage that, but that's all that they had back then, right?
Right.
And was HTML display, was that left over from Next, or was that done after the acquisition? Because even Bruce didn't know that.
That's a really good question. Well, if Bruce didn't know that, then I feel a little more comfortable, because I managed mail after Bruce did. but then before Bruce did again, I guess. But anyway, I thought that it was, I mean, I don't remember if it originated at Next or if it was sort of something newly developed at Apple after the act. I don't think it was after the acquisition.
Yeah, it was I don't think so. But it was very kindly a big ball of snot.
Is that the one where it's the text view and you can feed it HTML? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's essentially what it is. They basically, what somebody did, it is really a marvelous hack in a way. The text view in NextApp is basically an RTF view, right? It's a rich text view. And so basically somebody said, well, it's RTF. We have styling and whatever. We'll just overload it and make that HTML. And that's not really the way HTML works at all. So, but they actually made this sort of work. And you could do HTML3 sort of with this stuff. And that's basically what they were doing early on before we went in there and started Safari and WebKit. That's what they were using. And that was still better than the old, there was another HTML framework that was used for the original help system.
Oh,
and that was
shit.
That was carbon based. That was actually even worse.
Yeah, that was, I don't remember what that was, but I remember when we talked about getting our act together as far as HTML rendering goes. I mean, that was just a non-starter from the beginning. I mean, that was just kind of that was so 90s, the carbon-based one, that it was, I mean, it was clear, even
this
to people who didn't.
This wasn't for all the fanboys out there wondering if I'm talking about CyberDog. It was not CyberDog-based. I get so many questions about, did you use any of CyberDog? No, CyberDog was long dead by that time, before any of these two frameworks were available.
Wait a minute, hang on. I'm sorry, I'm just putting this together. Yeah. Are you the piece of shit who killed CyberDog?
Well, technically, but no, somebody else popped a cap in its ass before I ever got there. It took me several years to do it, believe it or not, but I killed HTML display. Bruce had wanted to kill it for so long because it was still used, I forget in what damn product, and we couldn't seem to get off of that crack pipe. But I think it finally...
Was it
was still in the system. No, it wasn't Sherlock. It was something. I'm the guy who also popped a cap in the ass of Sherlock too. So we can talk about that later on. But still, HTML was still technically in the system, because I forget for what app, but it was still in Tiger. Believe it or not, it was still a framework in Tiger. I think it died after Tiger. I'm not sure. But, you know, Bruce, before I showed up, he was the one who hired Ben Holler. And Ben Holler had tried to create a web browser based on HTML display. Do you remember that? That was called, Charlotte was the code name for that project. You know, Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, I know. I know Ben, and I remember HTML display. I did not know that that was a project that was going. Wow.
Yeah. You know, that was, and Scott decided that was not worth pursuing. So That's when he hired me. So when did you get disclosed, by the way, on Safari and WebKit? Because in the beginning, it was only Scott's direct staff and Bertrand and Avi that knew about it. I actually don't know that Steve knew about it when I was hired. So he didn't know who the hell I was until probably 6 months later.
You know what's funny is I don't think I was disclosed until relatively late. I don't remember exactly when, unfortunately.
Who were you? Were you working for Henri back then on IB or?
I was working for I was working for Henri. Actually, well, when I started managing the mail team, I reported directly to Scott, and that lasted about 7 or 8 months.
Yeah,
and you know, just a few months later, I was managing the mail team and the address book team, and Henri took over and was my manager as well. So I think he was doing AppKit, IB, and then mail and address book, and syncing as well. Sync services.
So he's phoning it in.
He would. Oh my God! Yeah,
slacking up. No,
exactly.
Let me tell you, Henri Lamoureux never phoned anything in.
No, not at all.
that talk about your workaholic. So,
and he had, you know, and I, to this day, I don't know how he did it, but somehow, I mean, he managed the sync services team, which at the time. Just managing the sync services team seemed to me like a beyond full-time job.
Oh yeah, totally.
Right? Let alone totally. Because I'm sure you remember this, Don. At the time, every VP and their uncle had a syncing algorithm that they thought was just the bee's knees.
Oh Christ.
And here they come, you know, with, well, here's how you need to think about syncing, and here's how you need to think about, you know, reconciling changes from two different sources, and you know, and the triangle problem. Remember the triangle problem?
Yeah.
You know,
Henri, bless his heart, he had the patience of Job to stand there and listen and nod and be polite. Where he's
a better man than I am, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had everybody in their brother telling me how a web engine should work, so I get a lot of practice at the same kind of horseshit too. In fact, I talked to Henri about that one time in a meeting. We were kicking back, relaxing. It's like, well, you know, this is a nice meeting because nobody is telling us how to do our jobs in this meeting, because it was basically just me and him, right? So
that's funny. I can't tell you how many people told me how phone apps should work and how an embedded system should work for modern smartphones as well, right? Okay. And literally, I was told in meetings, you have no idea how embedded systems work, and. The sad thing is that they were kind of right.
Oh, yeah, but it's not like they knew either.
But they, yeah, right. And they knew how embedded systems worked 10 years prior, but they had no idea how they should work. Like,
we hired a big VP who supposedly knew how embedded systems work, but he, you know, Sackerman, he was a nice guy, but, you know, he didn't work out.
Right.
So,
yeah, there's a lot of people. I mean, I imagine it's an awful lot like politics or, well, maybe like the NFL. Where everybody knows how you should do your job better than you know, right?
Right.
But they're not the ones who are.
I just realized we're making it Apple sound like a totally horrible place to work. And it really wasn't like that.
Oh, it was
quite
my
like
job.
That. You know, because people would run away screaming, but I never wanted to. Or wanted
the funny
to
thing is, I think we had a topic and. No,
we did?
I don't know. I thought so.
We did.
So this is way better. Just randomly.
Mitten wanted to talk about gestures versus buttons for navigation.
No, this is way more fun. This is great.
This is way more fun.
And Don mentioned WebKit versus UIKit.
It's like the thing is that whole conversation is a. You know, it's a non-conversation because people are always going to be surprised by it's like what I, well, you guys were there at NS North when I went off in that rant in my keynote, right? Where I was, when people ask me, you know, should it be WebKit or native? And it's like, I always say, what the fuck is the matter with you? You know, you're asking the wrong question. It's just such a stupid thing. Use what's appropriate for the time in the right area. And, you know, it's, I just hate it when people decide, well, I really like chocolate, so I want to smear chocolate on everything. Right? You know,
I've totally done that.
Yes. He's doing it right now.
So, yeah, it's a really stupid thing. And, at Apple, we tried, you know, we didn't always succeed. We tried to be a little bit more thoughtful about these kind of things, use the appropriate technology for the time and what's, you know, what's expected. And why would you want to cut yourself off for something? That's why when I heard about, you know, people always ask me whether I'm like excited about Firefox OS and Chrome OS and, you know, that's a bunch of people who like chocolate right there. I mean, they're, you know, they're trying to make everything one flavor, and that's so goddamn stupid. And then I hear about, what was it, last year, the Facebook app, who decided they had, you know, a really slow app, and they decided the problem was that it was all HTML-based, and they rewrote their app. And it, you know, I think hopefully what they've learned after that is, well, they just had a lot of really shitty code. It doesn't matter what it was written in. You know, if you refactor and rewrite it, you're going to improve it. It has nothing to do with HTML. And also, people don't understand what things are good at. You know, it's if you're going for speed, if you're going for touching the hardware and very subtle little gestures and effects, and you want to be on the cutting edge, why the fuck aren't you writing it in native? But if you're gonna render a whole bunch of content that you didn't have when you shipped your app, or doesn't exist locally, or can just change dynamically like crazy, or you want to deal with all these complicated secure transactions, why the hell aren't you using a web engine for that part? The fuck's the matter with you?
you know, for me internally, one of the apps that I never understood why it was developed as this native app and that it was just staying on the native app route was Radar. And it was especially around the time...
You and me both.
It was especially... And remember, you know, and it was especially around the time when IS&T, they had a new Radar update like every other week, it seemed, or maybe even every week. There was a new Radar that you had to download and install, and you know, and you get this big honking app. It's this, you know, 10 megabyte, whatever the fuck app.
And guess what? It's a dynamic interface to a big database. Why the fuck weren't they doing that in the web? And then we'd have other apps that I could never understand why they were web-based. I mean, I was flattered by this, but does everybody realize that the dictionary app is WebKit?
Oh really?
Yeah. The fuck is that WebKit? It's no real compelling reason to me. It's not a native app. I mean, that's all a web view.
You know, I think that's part of what our jobs were, though, Don, right? Was that, you know, there are, you know, at a place like Apple, you know, just this, and I'm sure that it's true of a lot of high-tech companies, there are these groups of domain experts, right? And there are these people who, you know, like, let's take the security team, right? Who, if you go and talk to them, they will let you know all of the dangerous things that are happening and all of the risks that we're taking with you know, the UI as we have it developed today or as we have it designed today. And if you go to the domain expert, you know, for something like security, and if they had their druthers, they would put up fucking alerts everywhere, right? And would be, you know, all kinds of authorizations and all kinds of, you know, sort of, you know, bells and whistles that show you that what you're looking at is a native hosted or a secured user interface. So that if you're typing in your password, that by golly, that's the place you should type in your password, and you know, and everything is going to be okay for you. You know, and the same is true with international, right?
I was in an exec review one time with Scott Forstall, and he tore somebody on the security team. I don't know which poor bastard it was. It tore him a new asshole for proposals of that kind. I don't think they ever let the security team talk directly to Scott after that.
but I think that's the problem is, I mean, and to be truthful, and no disrespect at all to anybody on the security team.
Oh, but they knew what the hell they were doing.
That was their job, right?
They knew what they were doing, but I referred to them, to my own managers, as the security Vulcans. Because you knew that going into a meeting with, you know, with the security team, you're going to get back this completely skewed view of technology and how users should interact with a given product. And what you need to do, what our job, you know, you, me, Scott, you know, people who were actually tasked with building a product that people might want to pay money for, was teasing out the most important aspects of what they were prescribing and ignoring everything else or deferring or pushing back on other things and looking for a better way to create an experience that was still appealing to users and at the same time was still very secure and very, very stable.
Right. I mean, ultimately,
this was something, go ahead.
The most secure thing is just never turn on your phone, right?
Exactly.
Moving forward
from
that.
You want people to use their devices. Right. This was a great lesson in user interface approach that I found from all the Apple executives, even Bertrand, who wouldn't tout his own UI cred. I mean, you know, he would always say that wasn't his forte, but he was a big believer, and certainly Scott was. Scott was just a genius at this kind of stuff. Is like, you know, we need to do the right thing for the user so they don't have to think about it. What's the path that we can go down where they never even have to know about this?
Right.
That was always a very, very hard thing in terms of security. And to the security team's credit, you know, we were making fun of it a little bit there. Over time, they started to really get this. I mean, they started to understand this kind of thing. And they were trying to do the right thing. It's like a lot of other, you know, it took a while to move people in the right direction that way. And I will say, believe it or not, the thing that helped the most was actually doing the iPhone. And the reason it helped the most was, and Steve mandated this, the iPhone had to be so damn simple. Mm-hmm. And Mac OS X owes a huge debt of gratitude for usability to iOS. Because we would pioneer things on iOS, trying to make them as simple as possible. And OS X, we go, oh, thank God, let's do it that way here on the desktop and see if it works, see if people will buy that too. And, you know, now that Federighi's in charge, I think they're trying to take an even more whole, you know, in charge of both, not that he's just because he's in charge, but he's in charge of both. They're trying to take an even more holistic approach to this. That's why I think, you know, the unveilings in June at WWDC were just so stunning for people in terms of, oh God, of course that's the way it should work. You know, that's the path of least resistance and I'm safe and I get my pony. But but what people on the outside don't realize, how goddamn hard that is to do. I mean, there are just legions of people in offices with very hard walls bashing their heads into them constantly trying to figure this out. I mean, it is really damn hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also why you can understand Apple's irritation and chagrin when companies like, you know, Samsung come around and just Xerox what they're doing. You know, if you really want to piss somebody off, you know, that's a good way to do it. So, what was it, Renee? You wrote a piece, it was this morning, about Samsung unveils the iPhone 5. What was it? I was talking to you about it before the show.
Yeah, the Galaxy Alpha.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you really want to irritate somebody at Apple, that's bring things like that up. Anyway, sorry. I went on a rant. Sorry.
No. No, that was great. And I completely agree. And that's the problem is that, well, let's see. Okay, there are a couple of things I wanted to say. One of them was that was one of the things that I loved about working with Scott or working for Scott was by default, if you go into a UI review with Scott, he is going to be pushing the UI team and pushing on engineering to come up with the most sensible sort of default, what we call default, right? Before yes. you ever did anything, to interact with an app, what are the default behaviors that it's going to use that you can change if you find your way into settings and you dick around a little bit, you could find your way into settings and change it to your liking. But really, what are most normal people going to want to do? And Scott had an amazing ability to zero in on those things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And to clear away if he detected that there was just, too much configuration or too much, assistance or wizards or whatever the fuck that were thrown up in users' faces. Or
never propose a wizard to Scott. That was right. A bad idea.
I mean, those are just bad words, right? I mean, if you say those words within Apple, especially in those UI reviews, I mean, you were effectively giving up, right? That was, you were just giving up on configuring an app or configuring some behavior or whatever. And so Scott was, it was great because, oh gosh, I forget where it was. There was some website, it may have even been Gruber or something like that, where they were talking about Picasso and how, there are the 10 illustrations of a bull, right? And right. and you sort of start with the most, the most detailed one at the very beginning and you sort of end. The 10th illustration is it's like four strokes, but if you look at it, it's a bull. Scott had this ability to, maybe he wouldn't get you to the 10th illustration, he was always going to take the HI team and engineering to the 8th illustration or the 7th illustration so that you could ultimately get to the 10th, but you were going to skip ahead a significant amount. And
but Scott was never going to let you be sloppy.
No.
Or do something stupid like that. I mean, that's one of the reasons that it's another reason that made him a great boss, like you say, is that focus on that experience and what the right thing to do was. Because this is the first step in making an experience delightful.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can make it so that you don't notice that you're having an experience in a way, you don't notice the other things, then the little things that you can do, the little curlicues, the little effects, then those just magnify how pleasant it is to use your device, right?
Right.
Because you never had to worry about the other horseshit.
Right.
And this was... this is not something that's easy. I mean, it is very, very hard to do, folks.
It's a real talent. It takes real talent.
Iteration. It takes a lot of tries.
Yes, exactly. That's true. Talent and perspiration, right? A lot of hard work, certainly. But it also takes working with a group of people who value the same thing, right? If you appreciate the fact that we're all trying to get to that 10th illustration, right? We're all trying to get there, and that's something that we all value. And here's a guy who can take you from the first one or the zeroth one to 7. Oh my God, that's a beautiful thing, right? Now you can iterate and test and iterate and develop, from the 7th illustration to get to that 10th. And at the same time, I think that's one of the things that for me anyway. But I think I can speak for a lot of people who really value what makes Apple a special place is that's what's so infuriating about a Samsung is they're just going to take that 10th thing and they're going to say, oh, well, of course you could express a bull in force.
Well, it's force obvious and that's why it can't be
right.
patented.
It's only obvious when you fucking see somebody else do it, right?
Yeah.
But it's certainly not obvious
Their ass across broken glass for like the last year.
Exactly. Then, now all of a sudden it's obvious how auto registration in FaceTime and in iMessage should work, right? I mean, these are the things that people kill themselves on to get these things to work well, or the fallback between iMessage and SMS or things like that.
Exactly.
These are examples, things that, if you describe these things to people, these are just mundane, you know, why would anybody bother? Just make every user on the planet, you know, go through these four screens and enter this horse shit, and now you've got a roughly equivalent experience. Well, no, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. And that's the beautiful thing about, you know, what we've done in the past is that understanding that that's not good enough. All right,
yeah.
I'll show.
So how do you guys feel?
I'm just, you know, I was wanted to mute myself so you didn't hear my amen, preach it kind of stuff there. That also made it a lot of fun working there. Remember when Nit and I were talking about what torment it was some days? Right. When you could actually see something in the end that was like that, you'd go, damn, that we're good. We're doing the right thing. And it's also, you know, sometimes when people like I was ranting, I don't know if this was part of the show or whatever, I was ranting about using the scanning software in OSDAN. You know, when something's bad, you know, we're our own worst critics. You know, we just hate it when we don't quite. When we don't quite make it, or we miss something obvious, it's really hard. And the other thing I was giving the security team a hard time. These are folks that really matured as a group in understanding this concept, along with having this tremendous domain knowledge and continuing to grow that on what's safe. To where by the time I left, you know, they were some of the people recommending, you know, let's not go over the top here, you know, and do something stupid. And that's what made me really proud of being a part of that, being a part of the group of people, just marvelous people too. You know, there were days when, you know, you wanted to take a few of them and slam them against the wall, but that means
they're doing their job.
Yeah, they're doing their job. But, you know, look at the, you know, look at how marvelous it tastes at the end on your plate after it's cooked. Try not to think about all those intestines that have to be wrapped around the raw meat, you know, to make the sausage. And, you know, you had to have your hands in all that. For a while there, it makes it much more pleasant, and that's why you keep doing it. It's really like a drug, really is like a drug.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, so we described some of the, you know, some of the bad things or some of the low points, right, around not really having time to yourself on a vacation or you know, just knowing that your Sundays, especially your Sunday evenings, are just going to be burned, you know, answering emails and fetching information and things like that. For me, one of the, you know, some of the best, you know, some of the high points, some of the stuff that kept me going was the fact that day to day, you know, or week to week, everybody gets new builds, right? I mean, there's new work that's going on, and there's new, you know, new features and new functionality keep kind of creeping into the build as the development process continues. And because we did have such a flat hierarchy and it was understood that you could go to anybody and talk to anyone, and that was just part of the culture, if something was really, really cool, I could go into someone's office and say, wow, this animation that you put in here for, you know, whatever the hell it was, is just really, that's just really awesome. You know, and it felt like every single day you get a new toy, and the new toy is getting better and better over time. And to be sure, I mean, there are places where it's, you know, it's just busted and maybe it deletes really important data. Although honestly, that didn't
like your happen. Home directory.
Yeah, maybe your home directory. That only happened a few times. iTunes. But
iTunes was deleting entire hard drives. It was Safari that was deleting.
It was your second home. Your second home. Second home.
Oh, thank you, Renee. That's very subtle. But yeah, no, no, Nitin, you're totally right. There were several technologies that were brought up, and I wanted to go up. I remember when Migration Assistant, when they created that thing, when somebody brought that up and demoed it in a meeting, I was seriously torn between just running up and giving that person a hug. It was just, you know, all the shit that you had to do as an employee there, you know, because you have to remember we constantly updated our systems. I mean, it was just, you know, I used to joke, you go into the office, get there at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and this was the day when you could do a net install. You know, before net install, you had to like run down to building one, find Dave or somebody else and get your set of disks.
Find Dave.
Yeah, find Dave.
Just literally, one guy called Dave.
Dave with the disks.
I know who Don's talking about.
Yeah,
Dave,
sure.
Dave Carvalho, right? Yeah, right on the corner. Exactly. Yeah,
it's second, just funny.
Second floor, Dave Carvalho. Get your set of disks and install yourself and go have a cup of coffee while your machine is. Thrashes putting on the new OS, and you did this every fucking day.
Oh, you must have loved iCloud Restore when it came around.
I left right around when that came up, but didn't it? Remember Purple Restore?
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that was,
you might have used that program once or twice.
Once or twice, or maybe every day,
constantly.
Constantly, even when you're on vacation, like the first thing that you need to figure out, for me anyway, first thing I need to figure out is, can I run Purple Restore over VPN, right? Yeah. Because I know I'm going to be away from the office. I want to be able to download and install new builds. And to be clear, this is while I'm on vacation. But it didn't matter.
Being able to run net install and Purple Restore over VPN, everything was just... peaches and cream. It was just, the world is perfect if you could do that.
and it was so much fun. That is honestly, that's like one of the, other than the people, for me, like the people is far and away what I miss the most.
The most, yeah.
But what I also miss quite a bit, and we've been able to thankfully replicate
I have a dead iMac next to me. Who I really miss is OnSite. And Nitin knows who I mean. Your Mac dies. You're in the middle of working. You walk down to building 3, first floor. You walk in from the interior. You walk in. You make the
Find Dave.
No, it's not different. Dave. Different person. You make that walk into building 3. You make a hard right. There's the poor bastard sitting and on site in that shitty room. It was just. It didn't matter. As long as I was there, that was always a shitty looking room. You remember the Dutch door there? Oh, my machine has died. And, you know, they just made it all better.
I remember there was a woman who worked in that room for years and years and years. And God, I wish I remember her name because she was
Dave.
Her name was probably Dave. Let's just go with Dave.
Let's just go with Dave.
But I would joke with Scott Herz about the fact that for whatever reason he would go down to OnSite. He'd have some problem with his laptop and he would go to OnSite.
Well, Scott was always breaking shit.
And he would just get these scowls from Dave, this woman who was down there. She was just never happy to see him and just, you know, and I was like, really? Are we talking about the same person? Whenever I go down there, she's like Johnny on the spot, like happy to work, you know, like do, you know, get this thing working, just going above and beyond like every single time I went down there. And so one time I actually followed him down. He was like, okay, my hard drive blew up. Let's go down and talk to Dave and see what she says. And so sure enough, we go in and Scott starts talking to her. And this is the first time that I've ever seen her just give someone the stink eye. And she's just giving Scott the stink eye like I've never seen before. And
how's she doing to Scott? Scott's like he's a teddy bear.
He's got to give off a
hyper teddy bear. What?
There's got to be a smell that he gives off. I don't know.
Or maybe that was the third time he'd been down there that day.
Yeah.
But then I swear, I poked my head around the corner and I just waved to Dave and was like, "Hi, how's it going? Can we get this fixed?" and like night and day, her attitude hers. And everything changed. She hated hers, is what I'm trying to say. Is Dave hated hers, and it was just a funny thing. But yeah, I guess I miss.
But the onside people, they were saints. It's like the remember we were must have been 3 years into the iPhone before we actually finally got a real Home Depot. Remember up on the third floor?
Yeah. With Lucky.
And that's what the room was called. It was called Home Depot. And God, I love that because you could just go in and you got all your new stuff, your prototypes. And yeah, if something was dead there in iOS land, a lot of times that's where you went.
But yeah, but the software, updating it every
day. That was building two, not building three. That was third floor building two.
Yes. For any of you historians,
anybody sitting in with a map of the campus, on site, first floor, building three, Home Depot, third floor, building two.
Don't be creepy.
And for all I know, they're still there. They're still in the same guy.
Everybody's called Dave, but here is exactly where to find them.
I said Dave because I didn't want to name drop, but you know, Carvalho actually is crazy enough to listen to this. You know, so I was talking about him.
It's my new thing. Anybody's
called Dave.
At Apple is just Dave.
Dave,
better
okay.
Bob, right? You remember we had the joke for a while that that we were going to give Scott a moratorium on hiring people named Chris. We had so goddamn many people named was it Chris or was it Scott?
I can't remember.
We had so many people named Chris.
Yeah, God, I remember that. I don't remember if it was Scott or was it Chris though. The only Chris that comes to mind is the you know one of your early hires, Chris.
Oh, C Blue, still a, Chris
yeah,
Bloomberg.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, he just left for Uber. Renee, was it Uber?
It might have been, yeah.
Renee was so thoughtful on Twitter. He tweeted this after I told him in a direct message, and he didn't give the attribution or the context of what it was
or the name
or the name or whatever it was about. But he tells me that on a DM one morning because Renee and I talk on Twitter a lot on DMs, what people don't realize. And he says, "Hey, did you know Chris Bloomberg went over to Uber?" And it was like a beat. And I immediately typed, "Oh my God, I hope it's not driving a cab." So that was just the first thing that came to mind. I don't know why. So, I hired C-Blue right out of Build, where he had started, I guess, as an intern.
That's right.
And so my group was the first, his first job as a real, you know, boy, I mean, a real engineer. You get to do real software engineering. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, the magnificent work he did in the beginning. I mean, we wouldn't have Java in Safari or in the beginning or plugins actually working if it hadn't been for Chris Bloomberg. And he did a lot of that on his own.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. So you're saying if... Bloomberg, if it wasn't for Bloomberg's work, we wouldn't have Java and Safari.
I wasn't going to say anything.
I just wanted to make sure.
It mattered back in 2001.
When the Terminators from the future come back, they know who to kill.
Yeah. Well, they're probably going to kill him for some other reasons. But it mattered a lot in the beginning because if you couldn't run that, do you know how much shit I got from banks about. Fucking Java and various whack ass plugins and how much I tormented Chris about getting, you know, all these little things working. It mattered back then.
Yeah.
I was talking about, I was a guy who popped a cap in the ass of Sherlock. There was nothing that would make me happier than to kill Java and plugins, certainly.
Right.
Or Flash, for Christ's sake. But you know, you have to be real. That's why, you know, I don't know if you saw the tweet a couple weeks ago. I tweeted a link from the Microsoft blog about Microsoft having to basically spoof Safari's user agent string on mobile.
I did see
that. And I said something like, wow, just wow, and I put the link. And I said, I don't know how to feel about that. I said, I guess my evil plan to take over the world worked. I don't know how to feel about that. And I forgot.
So when you tweeted that, I thought maybe they'd use WebKit.
Yeah.
But instead,
well, no, they're not going to do that. So I forgot when I tweeted that, that all my tweets get copied into Facebook, right? Because I have this. And one of my Facebook friends is Dean Hachimovich.
Oh.
And so he read that. He commented on it. I forget what he said, but Dean is just, he took it the right way. That I mean, I wasn't gloating or anything else, and that I was conflicted about it. And he's just a guy with a lot of class.
But you're totally paying for drinks next time.
Yeah, I'm totally paying for drinks. But Dean's a great guy. And but, you know, that's Microsoft is having to do what we had to do back then, is you have to, like, you have to be practical about what's possible. And Dean didn't write that blog post. I thought they, you know, they were just a tad whiny at the end, but that's what you have to do. And if that's the new Microsoft, well
it's pragmatic, right?
Yeah, it's pragmatic. It's a much more pragmatic approach.
That, I mean, that was definitely. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I you know, in the early days, I was so afraid any day I was going to get fired anyway. So, you know, I really didn't care. If the technical solution to the problem came from Beelzebub, I was going to use it, right? Because we had nothing back then. I mean, the Mac was like, you know, I remember when Brian Kroll started at Apple, he's also ex-Easel, and he knew he had such a daunting job ahead of him. I mean, our market share, the numbers, he would do slides every year, you know, Phil would force him to do slides at the top 100 and stuff. And, you know, our market share numbers were not good. They were basically headed into the toilet. So you did what you had to do. I know, you know, in the first iteration of the iPhone, nobody believed we could do a mobile phone or that we could do play in that world. And so we, you know, we did some things that, where we had to make some decisions about compromise and compatibility and stuff. You do what you have to do.
Yeah.
Because you don't have, Apple doesn't have to do any of that shit now. So thank God.
Yeah. Yeah. Now Apple's the 800-pound gorilla, right? You know,
Other exactly.
people have to do things to accommodate for Apple's behavior. But you're right. Back then, 10 years ago or even longer, it was very different. Apple had to try to fit into a world, fit into the Microsoft sort of defined world rather than defining it.
Well, you had to license ActiveSync, right?
No, we had to do that.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, dealing with Microsoft is dealing with like the mini-headed Hydra. You know, it depends on who you get. Maybe the teeth aren't so sharp on that one. And the ActiveSync folks were actually quite pleasant.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that was one of the easiest things to integrate for us too on iOS. It was, yeah, that was very relatively smooth. And I got to say, I mean, that they're, you know, even the Exchange ActiveSync, the mobile side of the protocol, it made a lot of sense. It was sort of one of those things where you look at it and you're like, well, why isn't the rest of the world work like this? Why, it's specifically IMAP, the IMAP protocol. Why doesn't it work more like EAS?
Well, IMAP's a piece of
or Gmail.
Shit.
IMAP is insane.
Yeah, it's insane. No, ActiveSync was a good pro, and they were good for supporting it and stuff like that. And we found that to be true with, you know, it's like when the Office 360 folks came around doing the web stuff, and we're trying to make sure that we, you know, our stuff in Iraq, they could run on mobile and stuff like that. They're real reasonable people. Yeah. You know, not everybody at Microsoft was like that, but like, the Office people were a little trying.
Yeah.
They came around. Only took a new CEO.
A quick break so I can tell you about Drobo, with smart storage to protect what matters. If you've ever had to set up and configure RAID arrays, it is not for the faint of heart, and it's not for people who are busy and don't have a lot of time but just need something that works. That's what Drobo is for. It is a storage appliance. It is sort of the Appleification of a RAID array. They offer 4, 5, or 8 drive capacity models with USB 3.0, Thunderbolt plus USB 3, NAS, iSCSI, basically any kind of interface you need, they have a model for. I want to tell you specifically, though, about the Drobot Gen 3. That's their most popular model, but it's gotten even better. I used to have the original Drobot, the old school Drobot, and this is a 4-bay Drobot, but now it's got USB 3.0, so it's faster than ever. It's 3 to 5 times faster than ever, in fact. It also gives you the ability to choose 1 or 2 drives for redundancy. So you can have more capacity if that's what you want, but you can also have more safety if that's what you need. It's optimized for Time Machine, so you can have all your backups going there. It'll even protect you from power failures. It has an internal battery, a small SSD cache to store data being written to the device in the event of power failure. And that's really what you want this for. You want an appliance that will keep your most important data, whether it's your project files, whether it's your personal photographs, anything that would be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to replace. You do want a copy on the cloud, absolutely, but you also want a copy that's readily accessible. If you have terabytes of information, getting them from a backup drive on your desk is so much faster than getting them off any type of server. So here's the deal. It's $349. That's 1/3 less than its predecessor. If you have an original 4-bay Drobot, you get the new one, you just pull those drives out, you push them back in, and you're up and running. It's really that simple. So what I want you to do is go to drobostore.com, www.drobostore.com, enter in code DEBUG50. That'll save you $50 off the purchase of any Drobo. If you want the new Gen 3, save you $50 on that. If you want one of the much bigger, you know, much more company-based alternatives, $50 off that too. Drobostore.com, offer code DEBUG50. Thanks, Drobo.
All right, so I want to make sure that we get to this if Nitin wanted to talk about it. And that was, Nitin, you mentioned something about gestures versus buttons and discussions around implementation and how to provide good experiences.
Oh, yeah, please, Nitin, talk about that. I'd like to hear that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I'm not sure how much I have to talk about, but, let's get started. I've got my glass of wine in front of me. But
that'd
really,
be your third glass of wine, right?
Yes. To be clear, for the record, for my kids who will be listening to this in the future, I'm on my third glass of wine right now. Yeah.
Good man.
So at the time, now this is 2005 at this point, right? And we understood that, you know, we had this great touch technology that was developed initially by Fingerworks, this company that Apple had purchased at the time. And we knew that we had this great technology, and we had the ability to not only detect swipes and presses, but really it was two-dimensional presses as well and two-dimensional swipes. So in other words, am I getting my dimensions right? It's actually three-dimensional swipes 3D, and yeah. three-dimensional presses, right? In other words, being able to figure out how hard a press was or how hard a swipe was, or how, you know, what was the stroke that was being performed, you know, was it consistently pressed for the duration of the stroke, or was it sort of, you know, was it pressed hard early on and then sort of tailed off into, you know, kind of a.
This wasn't actual pressure sensitive technology. No. Part of this was how much surface or how many points were activated. That's how you could tell like how strong something was. Like
it wasn't a digitizer.
It wasn't a digitizer.
Well,
it was,
the screen knows
it was very, it was very clever to know, you know, it was almost like coverage area, right, Nitin?
Yes, exactly. It was coverage area, but
it sees your hands before it sees your fingers that aren't on the screen, and it's tuned so that only when you're actually touching the screen, it detects it, right?
Right, exactly.
Because it's basically a magnetic field that it kind of figures
right,
out.
Right, but it can detect how much you're touching, how much of your surface area is on there. It can't really detect pressure per se.
Right, it's not a pressure thing, but it's...
Right,
it's, right.
But you can interpolate pressure because if you press your finger down, your finger gets effectively bigger on the device, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Based on the, you know, sort of the understood fleshiness of fingers, right? You could infer from that how hard pressure, how much pressure was actually applied, right?
And actually, UI Event has it in there, and I think it's public now. But at one point, it was private. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I know Wave was using it internally at Pixar to do exactly pressure sensitive drawing and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Just, Didn't they do that a few years ago? Made that public API? The information public?
At one point, it was private.
Maybe for the stylus people?
You needed to do KVO to get it. Anyway, sorry, I keep debuilding the Eden.
Go,
No.
I'm interrupting too. Run with it, Nitin.
No. This is all lovely. I love hearing this. So, but yeah. So the long and the short of it is that we had this new toy. We had this fucking awesome toy that we could play with, right? I mean, we had this technology that we had never gotten to that we never had a chance to play with, and we never. You know, and we understood that we had this screen that was, it was not only, you know, was it a very large screen compared to phones at the time, but the entire screen, you could receive touch input from it, from the entire screen. And so from very early on, there was an understanding that, I mean, there were some gestures where they're sort of deemed intuitively obvious. You know, things like pinch to zoom, right? Zooming in and zooming out on a photo were sort of in some ways. And to me, this is the most interesting part: is where is that border between intuitive and now you got to put up a goddamn user manual as sort of the first experience, right?
I was going to say, don't necessarily say obvious when you're talking to Samsung.
Yes, exactly. Well, exactly.
It's only obvious once you've done it, right? Yeah.
And by the way, you know, you'll notice
discoverable
in the UIs where you can pinch to zoom, there is still, even to this day, there's a double tap to zoom on that point, right? And so, I mean, really, in 2005, what I'm trying to say is in 2005, we had so many of the discussions that came many years later, that I got to see on the outside world, where there was this discussion around, you know, how natural really are these gestures? Just because you can perform them with a finger, or you can perform them with your thumb, doesn't mean that you would necessarily think to be able to perform them with your thumb or with a finger. And that was really the distinction that we drew, was what are the things that you might think are actually things that you can do, and what are the things that a user has the best chances of being able to sort of glean just from their own past experience and interacting with, you know, things just in the natural world that we could take advantage of and make it so that that they can get some delightful experience on the iPhone.
It's that debate between direct manipulation, of which there are few, and abstract gestures, of which there are many but aren't, you know, anywhere nearly discoverable.
I really remember this discussion a couple of years later when Ken Kishinda was proposing the app switching gesture, and how we were going back and forth on how the hell that would work and whether people would discover it, and that was like the whole original argument on steroids, because that was such a really hard problem to struggle with.
I'm so happy you brought that up, because I was going to try to find a way to do it. I wrote a piece like ages ago when that just came out, complaining that was a poor move.
You talk about the four-finger gestures on iPad?
Yeah, like if you do the five-finger pinch to switch and the four-finger swipe to switch between apps. I think it's a bad move because it limits what – I mean, I'm thinking about the iPad specifically – it limits what iPad apps can do with the number of touches that they've got, right?
Well, swipe your way from Fruit Ninja into Mail by accident.
Yeah, and I can imagine games really easily where four fingers swiping across the screen is not a weird thing, or a five finger pinch.
You've hit the second stage of this set of problems, not just the stuff that Nitin was talking about, but the big problem on touch interfaces is actually the limited palette you have.
Sure.
It's almost literally a palette, and it's figuratively a palette. And that's a real problem. So you were in the trenches much more so than I in the beginning. And, you know, were a lot of these same discussions going on back then in 2005? Because heard some of these.
Absolutely. I mean, there were so many... You know, right away, just like if you sat down with a touch device today and were tasked with, you know, coming up with all of the different things that you could do to manipulate the, you know, the workings of the phone, or manipulate the contents, the content that you're viewing on a phone. We were doing that back then, right? And and coming up with sort of the laundry list of, you know, here are all the different things that we can do, and here are the ways that you can manipulate things or interact with the device to better view your content or manipulate it or what have you. And forgive me for using these terms like manipulate and content. I fucking hate these words. But I feel like
it's cool.
I feel like
I've heard them so often in discussions at work that I just didn't even notice that.
Yeah. You need to use something, right? So it sounds douchey, but whatever.
Exactly. So please bear with me here. But really, you know, that there was, you know, with every single one of these discussions, it always came back to discoverability and whether because a lot of the gestures, if not almost every single gesture, needs to have some aspect of discoverability. Really, because of that, it really meant that these gestures had to be sort of what's the term? Sort of power user features.
Okay.
Accelerators, right? They had to be accelerators for other well-known, well-understood ways to manipulate the UI. So in other words, they had to be like the menu button, like hitting Command-Q to quit an app, as opposed to going to the file menu or the app menu and selecting Command-Q or
app. It's a very slippery slope with that when you pass that, because sometimes you can't even do some of those things on a touch device without using a gesture.
Right.
Which is why, for example, slide to unlock, one of the reasons I think Steve went down the path of skeuomorphism, but if you make it sort of looks like something that's physically touchable, it makes it much easier to, for you to intuit, maybe I should grab that thing that looks like it's indented.
Yeah,
and slide it with my finger. Plus, we're putting out in huge fucking letters, slide to unlock there. Because if you look at the original iPhone from 2007, when it debuted, to now, I mean, what do you have now? You have like a greater than sign and slide to unlock and this animation that highlights the letters going left to right.
And it waits a second. If you have Touch ID, it doesn't even give you that for a few seconds.
Yeah, exactly. So, and back then, what we were doing was we were trying to put road signs up and everything and give you visual cues on where to actually place your fingers, which is why also people complained in the early versions of the iPhone, like for mail.app or other things, that we didn't have ways to do things, you know, like easily delete messages or do this or that. You know, there wasn't a gesture. We just didn't know whether people would get the whole swipe to delete thing.
Exactly. Well, and bless you, Don, for bringing this up, because let me
people
get
thought
on my
we were fucking
soap,
idiots,
soapbox,
right?
For a minute.
Yeah.
Right. Where, okay, I understand that to me, I understand that there's this big push away from skeuomorphism. And I agree that in some cases, skeuomorphism just got out of hand, right? Like if you look at Game Center, you look at the Game Center UI, it's just like, I don't even know what the fuck that is, right? It's just this blend of real world items with virtual computing type computing centric items, and I can't make heads or tails of it, right? But at the same time, if you look back at what we were, and one other thing is, and I think that, you know, Steve Jobs has had for photorealistic rendering since he bought Pixar, right?
That's basically the reason, right there. In a nutshell, was buying
if I
Pixar.
Be a historian and armchair.
Thank you very
historian.
Much.
Yeah. Right, I think that he's had a thing for photorealism for a long time, and some of that I think is because computer graphics and interacting with GUIs has been so far away from photorealism for so long that I think that he saw that as kind of the mecca, you know, that we need to sort of pursue. But anyway, but to your point, Don, and I think that this is a very important thing, we are now the benefactors of wow. understanding how touch displays work and how they should, and what, like you said, Don, what does slide to unlock actually mean? If you didn't see a big gray thing that looked like a fucking button in Rails, literally,
Rails, exactly,
that right. allowed you to unlock your screen, would you today understand that a greater than arrow next to the word slide to unlock with glimmering animation that shows you, you know, that demonstrates you should move from left to right actually means slide to unlock? I really doubt it.
Oh, yeah. There is no way that if we had debuted the iOS 7 UI
yes.
in 2005, that's a big fail.
Yes.
That's a big fail. And if we had debuted the iOS 7 functionality for apps, like the version of Mail back then, nobody would have fucking figured out how to use it. Right. Or the version of Safari, you know, with its very subtle, like, is my finger like at the bottom of the page? Everybody figures it out now, right? But right. it would have just been maddening back then.
There is some element of evolution. For example, you know, originally you solve one-handed ease of use just by having a small screen. But as screens get bigger, as you introduce tablets, you can't reach across the screen. So then software has to do it. So you start getting things like consistent back and forward gestures and things like on iOS 8 with messages where you tap and hold to send a message or to take a selfie or something. It just evolves right. along with the as you want it to do more and more things, you have to evolve the way that those things get done.
Well, that's an interesting right. thing you point out, because my particular team got actually really involved in the iPad timeframe, because at typical Apple, we were trying to do too many things at once. So we temporarily took over doing some of the apps, actually some of Nitin's apps mm-hmm. for the team. And we tried to do it cooperatively and stuff, but everybody was just too many irons in the fire and not sleeping enough. But I remember when my team started tackling the iPad UIs, this was a terrible problem, because it was like this embarrassment of riches, almost all this space. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to do what Steve Jobs would retroactively complain about, you know, with other people, about taking an iPhone, you know, a phone app and scaling it up to a big screen. We knew from the beginning that that was a stupid thing to do. But, you know, which things do you get elaborate on, and what new gestures do you introduce? How far do you go? You can make things sort of larger now, but is that a good thing? And then you also have to think of, this isn't a whole ecosystem. If we do this for this particular app on the iPad device, what does that mean for the other device, right?
Well, you throw weather out the window first, like, and then you move on.
You know, some things were easier, but, you know, the hard things were, and we threw the phone app out, right? Because we don't have the phone app either. But Mail and Calendar, especially right away, were real challenges to not screw them up, because, you know, the temptation is to do something completely different, right? Because you can.
Well, and I would imagine that you could put the OS X Mail look, you know, like the list detail, list, what's it called? Master detail view, like the three pane approach. You could probably see that working on the iPad.
We prototyped it.
Yeah, exactly. We definitely looked at those types of things. And I think I mentioned this in the last podcast that I did, that very early on, actually, Steve was a big proponent of just blowing up the existing iPod or iPad iPhone UI.
Even though he scaling it later out. On, he, you know, retroactively said that was a stupid idea.
Exactly.
Keep in mind, is he did that about shit all the time. Was like about iPads themselves, about big screen devices. Mm-hmm. You remember before we brought the iPad out, he poo-pooed the idea. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Steve was constantly doing
no.
shit.
Yeah. It's just funny. I just love the idea of like Nitin sitting in his office with a prototype iPad and just hearing Steve just shit all over the iPad, you know.
Well,
I stayed up all night.
Thankfully, we actually never, you know, demoed just sort of blown up iPhone UIs to him. Right. Yeah. I think before we ever got Scott, to that point, we Scott were already Frank, arguing what? That no, we can't do that. This is not going to be a working UI. Just imagine. I mean, you don't even have to look at it, right? On a tablet form factor. Just imagine the current iPhone address book UI blown up to iPad size. It's terrible, right? Nobody wants that.
Terrible. And you know, Scott Forstall would never allow us to do that. Shit, Greg Christie would never allow us to get that far. He had more sense than that.
Right. And
so the one device that was actually easy to do, and Greg surprised me about this. I remember in the first staff meeting where we talked about this, embracing it, was the iPad mini. But that was simply... The reason why it made it easy to go to mini is because we had already done Retina.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially the iPad mini was the original iPad just scaled down. I mean, it was like the easiest goddamn product to do in one way. And what people don't realize on the outside is how fast we did that. You remember that? That was less than 9 months from inception to execution, I swear to God. On the mini, that was the fastest we ever did a product.
So I think I was out by the time the mini was...
What year did you leave?
2012. January 2012.
Well, it's like a month before I left, because I left in February. I think it was February 2012. But we'd already started the mini by then, before the time I left.
Yeah, we
well, I know you were disclosed on it, for Christ's sake.
Oh, yeah.
Like right down the hall, I was talking to you about it.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, we didn't ship it at that.
No, we shipped it anywhere near fall of 2012.
Yeah, right. It was announced in October.
But the conversation, I remember being in Scott's staff, I swear to God, it was in November, the end of November, when we were first talking about it. And I was like, really? But that was a whole different problem, right? That was what you had to do then was validate whether your old UI on non-Retina machines would work scaled down like 20%.
Yeah, exactly. That's really what it was. 63 PPI.
Exactly. Yeah. That was what I remember about the iPad mini, was actually trying to figure out all of the points where we understood, where we knew in the UI that your touch area was not that big. Where we were already on the hairy edge of having a big enough touch UI, those are the first things that we need to look at for something like a mini, because now they're going to be, like you said, 20% smaller. Can you still hit those things? So as an example, things like scrubbing within timeline,
the video player,
music app or video, right? Those are areas that it's understood within Apple. Those are areas where there's very little tolerance for having a much smaller touch target. And can we actually handle those appropriately on a physically smaller display?
I think they did a stunningly good job.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. I own a mini.
I actually didn't think it was going to work when it got announced or whatever, when like the rumor started.
Yeah. Well, yeah. This is exactly
that seems
why
like it's kind of weird. So.
And if there's one thing Apple has demonstrated over the years, they know how to do transitions, hardware transitions, software transitions, any kind of stuff like that. There is no company that is more agile in the tech business than Apple that way.
And agile at scale, which is amazing.
Yeah, agile and scale. The only thing that Apple still kind of sucks at, and they're getting better much faster than I thought they would, because I was a real nabob of negativity about this, was services. They're doing much better on services than I thought they would, scaling up faster than I thought they would.
I think so.
Well, you can't believe how bad it was. I was there. I had a front row seat for the Mobile Me
flamethrower.
The failure. You know, it wasn't my fault. I was actually trying to make those assholes successful, right? It was, they were shitting all over my abs. You know, that I was taking the eye on that, but the, you know, the poor bastards. And I mean, Steve really took it to him in a hard way. Those days are behind Apple. I think they're doing much better. This is the, you know, you were talking about Apple being the 800 pound gorilla. They are not even a gorilla in this space. They're more like a monkey, but they're a very strong monkey now. They're perhaps moving into the ape phase right now.
We should,
they're evolving. So they're doing much better this way. So
monkey with a whole lot of heart.
A monkey with a whole lot of heart. No, it's much better. I mean, think about everything in the whole ecosystem that Apple does better than, say, Amazon or Google. You know, that's
like Focus.
Focus is one of them. That's why I think people will be actually disappointed in some ways with the announcements this fall, because they won't get 50 things. They'll get like two.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, people always get overly excited about what's coming down the pipeline.
There's nothing like expectational debt to make you suffer from anticipation.
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 What the fuck is that?
It's an American word. I heard it on a talk show. It's got to be real.
American? Well, how dare you?
So,
well, we should get
but I could talk about Apple all day. And I was hoping we would break Nitin's previous record.
Next time, we'll do a follow-up.
By the way, I was so glad you did that that six-hour show, because it really is 6 hours that you talk. Right? Because I thought I talked a lot.
Yeah, no, you guys are both giant windbags.
Giant windbags. But I want to say, I know we got to wrap up because of other time restrictions, but I will gladly get half in the bag with Mr. Ganatra again and go another round.
Maybe we got a new show. Half
in the bag. Put
on it. Neaton Ganatra.
I'd be very happy to do it.
Because I know Neaton hasn't exhausted stories. He's got a lot more stories than that.
Because you gave him some.
We both have lots of stories. Maybe too many stories.
Maybe too many stories. And I know we're both willing to comment ad nauseum about the state of Apple today and the industry. So
to be continued.
And maybe some crazy people would be entertained by that. I don't know.
To be continued is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I really want to thank you. I want to thank you publicly, and this may be wine induced, but not really. I want to thank you for giving the company that I love a credible web strategy and a web story.
Oh, thank you so much.
It was, I mean, it initially, very early on when I first found out about Alexander, it scared the shit out of me.
You know the original name.
Right? It was one of these things that just worried me. And it was like, oh my God. Right? I was stuck in the 90s sort of mindset at the time that, oh my God, if we develop our own web browser, what the fuck? Now Microsoft is going to, we're not going to have IE. We're not going to have anything. Now we're stuck with goddamn OmniWeb. Right?
Yeah.
No offense to
Ken Case, who, by the way, is a really nice man. If you ever meet him, really nice man.
Oh yeah, he's a good guy.
Oh yeah, I mean, OmniWeb was a solid browser, but it was not.
Yes,
IE.
I think everybody takes your point.
It was essentially built on something that was very, very simple, similar to HTML display.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, when we came out, Ken, you know, Ken's not a stupid guy. He just chucked that shit right away. He was one of the first people to attempt to embed.
Yeah.
Kid. So
yeah, I remember that. Yep. Absolutely.
Ken's saying, well, thank you very much. I just wanted to tell you that, you know, I actually didn't realize how until I listened to your podcasts, and I was thinking about getting them in the novelization format, but I didn't realize how goddamn long you had been at Apple and that you had come up through one of my favorite routes. And I love people who come up this way. I didn't realize you came up from DTS.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Darren, who's, Darren
Adler.
Adler worked for me. And I was one of his biggest fanboys back in the days when.
Yeah.
So you know, the fact that you have all that rich history and you've contributed so many different projects at Apple, that's just marvelous. You knucklehead.
This is getting way too friendly. We've got to get some harder booze.
Yeah, I love you too.
It's only partially wine and deuce because I'm going to need a lot more wine than this cheap Zinfandel to do that.
So Don, while you are wine induced, where can people find you if they want to hear more of these great stories?
Well, not that I've written anything lately, but donmelton.com, where you can read some of my past exploits, or just talk to me on @DonMelton on Twitter, because just about anybody who says anything to me, I'll reply because I'm a whore. So.
Nitin, you're at Jawbone now?
I am at Jawbone, yep. And the best way to reach me, I think, still is at Nitin Ganatra on Twitter.
That's how I reach you.
Yeah, that's right. And Don, if you want to go get a beer sometime and talk about Mobile Me stories, I'd love to. Because I've got some that I'm not comfortable sharing in a podcast. Yeah, I'd love to chat with you about them. So.
Oh, yeah.
I'm booking a ticket now.
You know, it's
not like there's a huge distance between us either, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know about your other house or anything, but
yeah, there you go.
Sorry. You may have to edit that. Yeah.
It's the third house I'm editing out.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, guys. That was a blast.
I want to once again thank Drobo for sponsoring Debug. If you go to www.drobostore.com, use offer code DEBUG50, you can save $50 off the purchase of any Drobo, including the new Drobo Generation 3. Up to 4 drives, 1 or 2 drives redundancy, power failure protection, everything you need to keep the stuff that you want and need safe. Thanks, Drobo.